in grand reaction, the joy and gladness, the sobs and tears, and then the singing. Glory, hallelujah. Old John Brown. They united them until the first light of dawn. The jubilation of New England in reaction to the proclamation was not shared in the border states, or, for that matter, in much of the North. If marginal victory at Antietam had muted opposition to emancipation, the humiliating defeat at Fredericksburg and the ensuing winter stalemate raised anger to full volume. In his inaugural address, Governor of Kentucky James Robinson recommended that the state legislature reject the proclamation, warning that the monstrous doctrine would unify the South into one burning mass of indistinguishable hate. In Indiana and Illinois, heavily Democratic legislatures passed resolutions calling for a compromise peace with the South that would leave slavery intact. If abolitionist New England refused to live in a country that condoned slavery, they argued, then let New England secede. In Congress, peace Democrats, popularly known as Copperheads, capitalizing on the protracted slough of morale, opposed the new conscription laws and even went so far as to openly encourage soldiers to desert. Anecdotal reports from the army camps suggested that emancipation was having a negative effect upon the soldiers, numbers of whom claimed they had been deceived. They had signed up to fight for the Union, not for the Negro. Supreme Court Justice David Davis, chairman of Lincoln's nomination drive at Chicago, warned his old friend about the alarming condition of things. Only one means remained for saving the country, Davis insisted. Lincoln must alter the policy of emancipation and reconstruct the cabinet had they mistakenly supported it. Against such defeatist counsel, Lincoln held firm. He told Davis unconditionally that his policy was a fixed thing. When another old friend, Orville Browning, raised the specter that the North would unite behind the Democrats in their clamor for compromise, Lincoln predicted that if the Democrats moved toward concessions, the people would leave them. Nor was he worried that emancipation would splinter the army. While he conceded that wavering morale had inflamed tensions over emancipation and might lead to desertions, he did not believe the number would materially affect the army. On the contrary, those inspired to volunteer as a consequence of emancipation would more than make up for those that left. Lincoln was certain, he told the swarm of doubters, that the timing was right for this repurposing of the war. Know when to hold back, when to move forward. From a long way off, Lincoln had seen the inexorable approach of emancipation. Whoever can wait for it can see it. Whoever stands in the way will be run over by it. Speaking in a similar vein, he said, I claim not to have controlled events, but confess plainly that events have controlled me. Yet if events greater than the president swept him toward emancipation, the timing of the proclamation was largely a consequence of his choice and his determination. It is my conviction that had the proclamation been issued even 6 months earlier than it was, public sentiment would not have sustained it, Lincoln later said. Just so as to the subsequent action in reference to enlisting blacks in the border states. The step, taken sooner, could not, in my judgment, have been carried out. A man watches his pear tree day after day, impatient for the ripening of the fruit. Let him attempt to force the process, and he may spoil both fruit and tree. But let him patiently wait, and the ripe pear at length falls into his lap. Lincoln had carefully marked this great revolution in public sentiment, slowly but surely progressing. He was a careful listener and monitored the shifting opinions of his cabinet members. He was a shrewd reader, noting the direction of the wind in newspaper editorials and the tenor of conversations among the people in the North, and, most centrally, in the opinion of the troops. Although he had known all along that opposition would be fierce when the proclamation was activated, he judged that opposition of insufficient strength to defeat the purpose. This acute sense of timing, one journalist observed, was the secret to Lincoln's gifted leadership. He always moves in conjunction with propitious circumstances, not waiting to be dragged by the force of events or wasting strength in premature struggles with them. In contrast to the mental turmoil and stressful reflections Lincoln had experienced in the autumn months preceding the proclamation, once the decision was finally made, a determined stillness descended upon him. For Lincoln, wrestling with thought was no figure of speech. It was an exhaustive mental combat from which he emerged with confidence and clarity. It had been a torturous ordeal to make up his mind, but he now felt confident that his lengthy decision-making process had yielded the right course and that the country would be ready and willing to follow him. At a time when the spirits of the people were depleted and war fatigue was widespread, Lincoln had gotten a powerful second wind. Where others saw the apocalyptic demise of the founders' experiment, he saw the birth of a new freedom. This conviction of progress not only proved a correct reading of the temper of the times, but was instrumental in shaping it. Just as the cabinet had cohered prior to the public issuance of the final proclamation, so, under Lincoln's leadership, recruitments to the army picked up, and the Congress, despite Copperhead opposition, passed all the administration's war-related bills, including financing and conscription. A further test case of the battle for Northern support was met in early April, when special congressional elections were held in Connecticut, Rhode Island, and New Hampshire. In all three states, Republicans and loyal Democrats soundly defeated Copperhead candidates. The Copperheads had gone too fast and too far in talking about a compromise peace, exactly as Lincoln had anticipated in the dark days of January. This stunning election triumph, the New York Times noted, puts the administration safely round the Cape and ensures it clear seas to the end. It was not to prove that simple, but a corner had surely been turned. Lincoln had wisely let the reaction against the defeatist sentiments grow, then worked to mobilize a renewed spirit. The story of how he was able to recognize, align, harness, and creatively shape this swelling movement toward the acceptance, incorporation, and empowerment yielded by the emancipation provides a demonstration of the rare stuff of transformational leadership. Combine transactional and transformational leadership. Among the many variants of leadership, scholars have sought to identify two seemingly antithetical types, transactional, by far the more common, and transformational. Transactional leaders operate pragmatically. They appeal to the self-interest of their followers, using quid pro quos, bargains, trades, and rewards to solicit support and influence the behavior of their followers. Transformational leaders inspire followers to identify with something larger than themselves, the organization, the community, the region, the country, and finally, to the more abstract identification with the ideals of that country. Such leaders call for sacrifice in the pursuit of moral principles and higher goals, validating such altruism by looking beyond the present moment to frame a future worth striving for. Yet a straightforward application of these two forms of leadership fits Lincoln no better than his pants fit his long legs or his sleeves, his gangling arms. For Lincoln, pragmatic transactional strategies provided the nuts and bolts of principled transformational leadership. Before the spring elections in Connecticut, Rhode Island, and New Hampshire, for example, Lincoln had telegraphed New York's Republican Party boss, Thurlow Weed, asking him to take the first train to Washington. "Mr. Weed, we are in a tight place," Lincoln explained over breakfast. "Money for legitimate purposes is needed immediately, but there is no appropriation from which it can be lawfully taken. I don't know how to raise it, so I sent for you." Before the night had ended, Weed had delivered $15,000 to help finance a secret fund to influence the voters in the three states. Depending on the group he was trying to persuade, Lincoln could, and often did, advocate emancipation from both transactional and transformative vantage points. In city after city, Lincoln orchestrated mass rallies designed both to invigorate the spirit of loyal Unionists and to quell Copperhead defeatism. For one such rally in his hometown of Springfield, Illinois, where Copperhead influence still exerted great force, he composed a lengthy letter to be read to the crowd. "Read it very slowly," he instructed the reader, his old friend James Conkling. "To be plain," Lincoln minced no words, "you are dissatisfied with me about the Negro." He then proceeded to enumerate the reasons such dissatisfaction was both ill-placed and inappropriate. "I thought that in your struggle for the Union, to whatever extent the Negro should cease helping the enemy, to that extent it weakened the enemy in his resistance to you. Do you think differently?" he queried, challenging them in a fundamentally pragmatic basis. "I thought that whatever Negroes can be got to do as soldiers leaves just so much less for white soldiers to do in saving the Union." After establishing the practical benefits the black troops provided, Lincoln ventured into the transformative core of his message. "If they stake their lives for us, they must be prompted by the strongest motives, even the promise of freedom. And the promise being made must be kept." In the end, this public letter was a skillful primer of the elevation from a practical to a moral purpose to set an inspirational charge that characterizes transformational leadership. Nowhere was the effect of Abraham Lincoln's transformational leadership illustrated more sharply than in the changed attitudes of the soldiers toward emancipation. During the first 18 months of the war, only 3 out of 10 soldiers professed a willingness to risk their lives for emancipation. The majority were fighting solely to preserve the Union. That ratio shifted in the wake of the Emancipation Proclamation. Following Lincoln's lead, an overwhelming majority of the soldiers came to view emancipation and the restoration of the Union as inseparably linked. How had Lincoln's leadership set this metamorphosis in motion? How had he transferred his purpose to the soldiers? Be accessible, easy to approach. The response of the troops was grounded in the deep trust and loyalty Lincoln had sown among the rank-and-file soldiers from the very beginning of the war. While visiting troops around Washington and on the battlefield, he shared their beans and hardtack. He inspected their sleeping quarters. He asked after their families. He chatted with fellow occupants of the soldiers' home and ministered to Union and Confederate wounded alike. "He cares for us," one soldier said to another. "He makes us fight, but he cares." Everywhere he went, he invited soldiers to call upon him if they felt they had been unfairly treated. And indeed, an estimated 2,000 soldiers took him at his word, availing themselves of his offer to come to his office, to complain, be entertained, or simply come face to face with their commander-in-chief. This open-door policy, Lincoln explained, is the link or cord which connects the people with the governing power. Stories of these encounters quickly circulated among the troops, as did accounts of Lincoln's clemency, his relentless efforts to find cause to stay the hand of the executioner. In letters the soldiers wrote home, accounts of Lincoln's empathy, responsibility, kindness, accessibility, and fatherly compassion for his extended family were common. They spoke of him as one of their own. They carried his picture into battle. What a depth of devotion, sympathy, and reassurance were conveyed through his smile, a Wisconsin soldier recalled. Again and again they referred to him as Father Abraham, Uncle Abe, or Old Abe. The biblical references and the filial relations connoted a reciprocal emotional charge and a shared vulnerability. The selfsame mark of pain and anguish upon his face and demeanor made clear that they endured the war's toll together and suffered a shared lot. "He looks careworn," wrote a recruit from Pennsylvania. "I could not help uttering the prayer, God bless Abraham Lincoln." clearly the sacrifice Lincoln was asking of the soldiers he had first asked of himself. Another Pennsylvania soldier told his mother he would not be returning home when his term of enlistment was up. A country that is worth living in time of peace is worth fighting for in time of war, so I am yet willing to put up with the hardships of a soldier's life. Such was the credibility that Lincoln had established with the soldiers, that it was no longer a question of fighting solely for the Union, but rather for the dual purpose of Union and emancipation. If he says all slaves are hereafter forever free, wrote one soldier, amen. Another confessed he had never been in favor of the abolition of slavery, but was now ready and willing to fight for emancipation. A new direction had been set and accepted. Nothing would drive home the transformative power of the Emancipation Proclamation more powerfully than the recruitment and enlistment of black soldiers. As chief advocate and recruiter of black troops, Frederick Douglass sought to stir young black men in one northern city after another. You will stand more erect, walk more assured, feel more at ease, he promised. Once let the black man get upon his person the brass letters U.S., let him get an eagle on his button and a musket on his shoulder and bullets in his pocket, and there is no power on earth or under the earth which can deny that he has earned the right of citizenship. Blacks responded in thunder to the enlistment call, signing up by the tens of thousands. This initial wave of enthusiasm soon receded, however, when the black enrollees learned they would not receive pay equal to white soldiers. Likewise, they would neither earn an enlistment bonus nor be eligible to become officers. Feeling he could no longer in good conscience persuade soldiers to enlist, Douglass decided to call directly upon Lincoln. I was never more quickly or more completely put at ease, Douglass recalled of their first meeting. As Douglass described how the lack of fair play hampered recruitment, Lincoln listened with earnest attention and with very apparent sympathy. Although politically expedient at the time, the discriminatory policy, Lincoln now agreed, was wrong. In the end, Lincoln promised, black soldiers shall have the same pay as white soldiers. Douglass later related he had never seen a more transparent countenance. A relationship of trust and decency was formed at that initial meeting, which would prove instrumental in the months ahead. He treated me as a man. He did not let me feel for a moment that there was any difference in the color of our skins, Douglass later said. I am satisfied now that he is doing all that circumstances will allow him to do. Not only did blacks eventually enlist in record numbers, adding nearly 200,000 troops to the Union war effort, but, according to official testimony, they fought with striking gallantry. I never saw such fighting as was done by the Negro Regiment, General James G. Blunt wrote after one early engagement. They fought like veterans with a coolness and valor that is unsurpassed. After the battle at Fort Hudson, a white officer openly confessed, "You have no idea how my prejudices with regard to Negro troops have been dispelled by the battle the other day. The brigade of Negroes behaved magnificently and fought splendidly. Could not have done better." Even commanders formerly opposed to his proclamation, Lincoln stressed, now believe the emancipation policy and the use of colored troops constitute the heaviest blow yet dealt to the rebellion. Put ambition for the collective interest above self-interest. In the country at large, however, approbation and acceptance of emancipation vacillated with the fortunes of the Union troops. Despite the Union victory at Gettysburg, Lee's army once again escaped, regrouped, and defeated General Ulysses S. Grant's Union forces in a nightmarish sequence of battles at Spotsylvania, Cold Harbor, and Petersburg. For both North and South, the spring of 1864 was a time of physical and spiritual depletion, darkness, and death. By summer's end, The number of dead, wounded, captured, and missing in action had reached more than 580,000 in the north and nearly 470,000 in the south. Desperation gave rise to a mad cry for peace at any cost. The mood of despondency that enveloped the North threatened Lincoln's re-election. "The tide is setting strongly against us," Republican National Committee Chair Henry Raymond warned Lincoln in late August. If the election were held at that moment, he would likely lose his bid for a second term. So doubtful were the Republican committee members about Lincoln's prospects for re-election that they had yet to mobilize the party machinery. The problem was not simply the lack of military success, but the suspicion that Lincoln's insistence on emancipation was the main obstacle to peace. For the Republicans to have any chance of victory, Raymond told Lincoln, he must commence peace talks on the sole condition of reunion, leaving the issue of slavery for later consideration.
"I confess that I desire to be reelected," Lincoln acknowledged. "I have the common pride of humanity to wish my past 4 years administration endorsed. And at the same time, I want to finish this job." Nonetheless, he rejected Raymond's plea that he dispatch a commissioner to Richmond to meet with Confederate President Jefferson Davis. To sound out conditions for peace without demanding the end of slavery, Lincoln considered utter ruination. He would rather face electoral defeat than renounce emancipation. "He should be damned in time and in eternity," he vehemently declared, if he abandoned his commitment to the twin goals of union and freedom. Moreover, those who accused him of carrying on this war for the sole purpose of abolition must understand that no human power can subdue this rebellion without using the emancipation lever. The word firmness is insufficient to connote the iron will with which Abraham Lincoln now stood his ground. Overnight, the fall of Atlanta on the 3rd of September elevated Northern spirits. "Glorious news this morning," George Templeton Strong exulted. "It is coming at this political crisis, the greatest event of the war." As headlines filled Northern newspapers and throngs congregated in cities and towns to fire guns and ring bells, Lincoln's friend Leonard Swett, who only weeks before had written that Lincoln's re-election was beyond any possible hope, now believed that God had given the Union its glorious victory to make the ship right itself as a ship in a storm does after a great wave has nearly capsized it. It was clear to both parties that the massive soldier vote might well sway the election. Democrats, remembering the devotion George McClellan had once inspired among his men, had chosen the former general as their nominee on a platform that severed abolition from reunion, thereby promising an early conclusion to the war. "We are as certain of 2/3 of that soldier vote for General McClellan as that the sun shines," a Democratic operative jauntily predicted. The soldiers' vote was also of paramount importance to Lincoln, but for far deeper reasons than its numerical bearing on the outcome of the election. He trusted the fellowship that he had strengthened with their common investment in the war. Such intimacy did Lincoln feel for the rank-and-file servicemen, that he said that if he had to make a choice, he would rather be defeated with a soldier vote behind him than to be elected without it. That circumstance never came to pass. Lincoln swept the Electoral College by a tally of 212-21 and captured more than 7 out of 10 soldiers' votes. In casting their ballots for Lincoln, the soldiers knew that in all likelihood they were prolonging their personal risk and the duration of their wartime service. They were voting against their self-interest for the greater collective interest that Lincoln had powerfully expressed in his talks with them. "This contest is not merely for today, but for all time to come," Lincoln had reiterated in numerous ways. "I happen temporarily to occupy this big White House. I am a living witness that any one of your children may look to come here as my father's child has. It is in order that each of you may have through this free government which we have enjoyed an open field and a fair chance for your industry, enterprise, and intelligence, that you all have equal privileges in the race of life, with all its desirable human aspirations. It is for this the struggle should be maintained. And when they went to the polls, the soldiers voted not for their own safety, but for the man who had come to represent the cause they fought for together. Winning a second term fired Lincoln's resolve to secure emancipation beyond the rebel South, to encompass the entirety of the nation. With all possible speed, he sought a formal guarantee that slavery would be abolished within the United States. Such an assurance could not rest upon an executive order, but rather must be written into the law of the land by way of a constitutional amendment. Executive war powers had enabled the circumvention of constitutionally protected slavery. Now, the supple Constitution must provide its own permanent remedy to abolish slavery in the form of the 13th Amendment, introduced on January 6, 1865. Informed 3 weeks later that the requisite two-thirds passage was two votes short, Lincoln stridently intervened with his Capitol Hill emissaries. He made it understood that his transactional executive power extended to government jobs for relatives and friends, pardons, ministries abroad, and campaign contributions. It was not long before they had scoured up those two votes. When the final tally was announced, remarked a witness, there was an explosion, a storm of cheers, the like of which no Congress of the United States ever heard before. To a crowd of celebrants who came to serenade him the next evening at the White House, Lincoln proclaimed that the occasion was one of congratulation to the country and to the whole world. But he reminded them that there is a task yet before us, to go forward and consummate by the votes of the states that which Congress so nobly began. A week later, before an immense crowd at Boston Music Hall celebrating the House passage of the 13th Amendment, abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison asked the question, "And to whom is the country more immediately indebted for this vital and saving amendment of the Constitution than perhaps to any other man?" "I believe I may confidently answer, to the humble rail splitter of Illinois, to the presidential chainbreaker from millions of the oppressed, to Abraham Lincoln." Lincoln shrank from the heroic appellation, the great emancipator. "I have only been an instrument," he insisted. "The anti-slavery people of the country and the army have done it all." Such humility did not suggest a lack of ambition. On the contrary, from the time he was a young man, Lincoln had harbored a consuming ambition to make a difference in the world. During the nadir of his depression in his early 30s, he had confessed to Joshua Speed that he would gladly die, but that he had done nothing to make any human being remember that he had lived. He would be remembered now. When Speed came to the White House shortly after the signing of the proclamation, the two old friends reminisced about that grim early period in Lincoln's life when his desire for remembrance had fueled his recovery from depression. Far beyond any grand projection when he was young, Lincoln had now rendered service to his fellow man. "I believe that in this measure," Lincoln flatly declared of the proclamation, "my fondest hopes will be realized." Abraham Lincoln never lived to see the completion of the task he'd begun with his proclamation, the ratification of the 13th Amendment by three-quarters of the states in December 1865. Slavery, the when he had spoken of cutting out of the Constitution, had been excised at a terrible cost at last. "A king's cure for all the evils," he had said of the anticipated amendment. "It winds the whole thing up." And the great convergence of the man and his times Lincoln had driven, guided, and inspired his cabinet, the army, and his countrymen. "Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history," he had told the Congress a month before he issued the Emancipation Proclamation. "The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. And giving freedom to the slave, we assure freedom to the free, honorable alike in what we give and what we preserve. We shall nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope of earth." It was through the language of his leadership that a moral purpose and meaning was imprinted upon the protracted misery of the Civil War. So surely did Lincoln midwife this process of social transformation that we look back at the United States before Abraham Lincoln and after him.
Chapter 10. Crisis Management. Theodore Roosevelt and the Coal Strike. It is a dreadful thing to come into the presidency this way, but it would be a far worse thing to be morbid about it, Roosevelt wrote a friend days after President William McKinley's long-drawn death. Here is the task, and I've got to do it to the best of my ability, and that is all there is about it. Widespread warnings of panic swirled that the stock market might well crash unless Roosevelt provided reassurance that a steady and cautious hand had taken the helm. Accordingly, the new president immediately asked every member of McKinley's cabinet to stay on. His friends worried that some of these men might not be loyal to him, but he said that if those he kept were loyal to their work, that was the loyalty for which he cared the most. If they were not, he would swiftly change them. At the same time, he reached out to the conservative political boss Mark Hanna, McKinley's closest friend, who was now face to face with the situation he had dreaded when he cautioned fellow Republicans against putting that madman Roosevelt in the vice presidency. "I hope you will be to me all that you have been to him," the disciplined new president now told the bereft Hanna. And furthermore, he issued a conciliating pledge. "In this hour of deep and terrible bereavement, I wish to state that I shall continue absolutely unbroken the policy of President McKinley for the peace, prosperity, and the honor of the country." Yet even as Roosevelt publicly promised continuity, he knew that if he pursued McKinley's conservative policies to the letter, it would give a lie to all he had stood for in his fight to refashion the Republican Party into a progressive force. The breadth of his hands-on experience at different levels of government, from the state legislature to the police department to the governor's chair, had sensitized Roosevelt to the hidden dangers of the age. The rise of gigantic trusts that were rapidly swallowing up their competitors in one field after another. The invisible web of corruption linking political bosses to the business community, the increasing concentration of wealth, and the growing gap between the rich and the poor, the squalid conditions in the immigrant slums, the mood of insurrection among the laboring classes. So, on his first day in office, Theodore Roosevelt signaled to journalists that despite his endorsement of the status quo, a new political era was dawning. The Constitution, he reminded them, had provided for his succession as president, and he was determined to act in every word and deed, precisely as if he, and not McKinley, had been the candidate for whom the electors cast the vote for president. He had cut his political teeth in the endless cross-currents and whiplash between machine bosses and reformers. He mistrusted and feared the former, and often disappointed the latter. If it was necessary to temporarily bide his time to avoid upheavals in the market, anyone who thought he would follow the pro-business path laid out by William McKinley badly misconstrued his nature and his intentions. The impact of Roosevelt's outsized personality made it immediately clear that a new leader was in charge, one who fathomed the country's challenges in a very different way than his predecessor. The infectiousness of his exuberant vitality made the country realize there was a new man in the White House, observed journalist Mark Sullivan. Indeed, a new kind of man. His high spirits, enormous capacity for work, his tirelessness, his forthrightness, his many striking qualities gave a lift of the spirits to millions of average men. Throughout his political career, Roosevelt's conception of leadership had been built upon a narrative of the embattled hero, armed with courage, spunk, honor, and truth, who sets out into the world to prove himself. It was a dragon-slaying notion of the hero leader, and Roosevelt had the good fortune to strike the historical moment in which he could prove his mettle. Under the banner of the Square Deal, he would lead his country in a different kind of war, a progressive battle designed to restore fairness to America's economic and social life. The Great Coal Strike of 1902, the subject of this case study, is emblematic of the widespread mood of rebellion among the laboring classes in the wake of the Industrial Revolution. The unfolding of the president's creative handling of what was viewed as the most formidable deadlock in the history of the country offers a demonstration of groundbreaking crisis management. As cold weather approached in the fall of 1902, widespread panic set in. Still, there were no signs of a settlement in the six-month-old strike between the United Mine Workers, the largest union in the nation, and a powerful cartel of railroad presidents and mine owners who monopolized anthracite hard coal production in Pennsylvania. The massive labor stoppage was already the biggest and longest-running news story of the year. The Northeast depended almost entirely on anthracite coal for winter fuel. Like a black river with myriad tributaries, coal ran from the collieries and railroad cars in Pennsylvania to the factories and mills, the hospitals, schools, and dwellings of New York and New England. Damming that river of coal would plunge the entire region into a coal famine. And like a shortage of bread, coal famine presaged suffering and violence for the populace at large. Indeed, as this seasonal tragedy began to play out before the public and wintertime drew closer, the coal strike assumed a shape so acute that even conservatives warned Theodore Roosevelt that if the situation remained unchanged, we would have within a fortnight the most widespread and bloody civil disturbance we have known in our time. What made this situation so frustrating for Roosevelt was the remarkable fact that neither legal nor historical precedent warranted presidential intervention to manage any single aspect of the crisis. So pervasive was the belief that government should refrain from interfering in the workings of an unregulated free market that quarrels between labor and management were considered wholly private matters. A chorus of voices, including Roosevelt's family, closest friends, and colleagues, advised him that unless the state of Pennsylvania requested emergency troops to quell violent disorder, he had no power whatsoever to take action. Not only did Roosevelt have no legal authority to intervene, but from a political vantage, he was forewarned to steer clear. Meddling would poison support from the business community, the Republican Party's mainstay of support. Furthermore, if he tried and failed, the responsibility for failure would be laid at his door, damaging his party's prospects in the upcoming fall midterms and his own political future. Roosevelt's handling of the six-month strike unfolded in three seasonal stages, beginning in the spring of the year. Spring. The catastrophe the strike would bring on by October was nowhere to be seen in May 1902, when 147,000 miners walked out. No one conceived then that the strike would become what labor leader Samuel Gompers later deemed the most important event in the labor movement of the United States. The unexampled surge of industrial consolidation that produced the giant coal combination had begun a decade earlier, when the coal-carrying railroads, the Reading, Lackawanna, Erie, and others, under the auspices of J.P. Morgan, Wall Street's most respected financier, had begun purchasing coal fields, using their power over freight rates to buy out one independent mine after another. The United Mine Workers had only recently gained footing in the anthracite region. Led by John Mitchell, a charismatic, conservative, articulate young leader who had worked in the mines before becoming a union official, the union had organized tens of thousands of anthracite miners. All during the spring of 1902, Mitchell was under pressure from his rank-and-file miners to deal with a host of troubling issues, including low wages, 10-hour days, and brutal working conditions. To forestall the growing demand for a strike, which Mitchell feared would risk everything in one great fight, the union leader went to New York to discuss potential areas of agreement with the owners. When the owners, led by George Bear, the wealthy college-educated president of the Reading Railway, flatly refused to sit at the same table with a common coal miner who had worked with his hands for 15 years and was now a labor agitator, the miners voted to strike, their pride aggravated by the owner's condescension. Though Mitchell had initially opposed the idea of a strike, fearing the new union could not sustain a major conflict during its formative time, he now assured the workers that he was committed to do everything he could to make the strike successful. He implored them to stay together. "If you stand as one man, and stand long enough and strong enough, you will win. If you divide, you will lose." Such was Mitchell's authority that at his signal almost every miner walked out on the first day, a response far exceeding the most sanguine hopes of union organizers. Mitchell's hold on the men, many of them immigrants who barely spoke English, was legendary. Case in point, when news of President McKinley's assassination first spread to the coal region, the workmen had gathered together, openly grieving. "Who shot our president?" they cried out. Upon learning that President McKinley, not President Mitchell, had been shot, they were greatly relieved. Calculate risks of getting involved. Even at this early stage of the strike, Roosevelt was thoroughly awake to the potential perils of the situation. Though repeatedly told that he had no earthly responsibility for the strike and should do nothing to interfere, he recognized that if the strike continued for any length of time, the public would tend to visit upon our heads responsibility for the shortage in coal, precisely as Kansas and Nebraska visited upon our heads their failure to raise good crops in the arid belt 8, 10, or 12 years ago. In other words, if people were hurt, their leader would be held accountable, whether or not he had the legal authority to act. Furthermore, passivity ran counter to Roosevelt's disposition, as well as his conception of leadership. His study of history persuaded him that there were two schools of thought regarding presidential power. The first, identified with James Buchanan, was a narrowly legalistic view that the president is the servant of Congress rather than of the people, and can do nothing, no matter how necessary, unless the Constitution explicitly commands the action, thus resolving every doubt in favor of inaction against action. A second opposing philosophical stance, exemplified by Abraham Lincoln, considered the executive the steward of the people. Under this conception, to which Roosevelt wholeheartedly ascribed, it was not only the executive's right, but his responsibility to do whatever the needs of the people demand, unless the Constitution or the laws explicitly forbid him to do it. So it happened that many months before the situation had reached crisis proportions, Roosevelt was proactively seeking ways to intervene, to create a position of solid ground from which to lead. Rather than rush in, however, he demonstrated a methodical, understated, patient demeanor at odds with his storied headlong leadership style. "I am slowly going on," he told the journalist Jacob Riis, "working within my limited range of powers and endeavoring neither to shirk any responsibilities nor yet to be drawn into such hasty and violent action as almost invariably provokes reaction." Secure a reliable understanding of the facts, causes, and conditions of the situation. On June 8th, a month into the strike, the president took a small, establishing step to prepare the public for future executive action. In conversation with his Commissioner of Labor, Carol Wright, a provision in a law enacted years earlier came to light. This provision authorized the Labor Commissioner to make special reports on particular subjects whenever required to do so by the President or either House of Congress. Roosevelt thereby verbally directed Wright to ascertain all facts possible relating to the present controversy. Wright, regarded as one of the foremost statisticians in the world, was the right man for the job of conducting an even-handed investigation into the causes and conditions underlying the strike. He had dedicated his innovative career to the study of working conditions in the new industrial age, and for a numbers man, he possessed an unusual sensitivity to the all-too-human elements entangled in both sides of the strike: authority and control, recognition and pride. Roosevelt's call for the report was not simply a request for a statistical accounting. As he hoped, a report would push things forward. The president's action in sending the Commissioner of Labor to investigate the coal strike is thought by some to forecast presidential influence, noted one editorial. President Roosevelt evidently looks upon the strike not as a private quarrel, but as a conflict in which public interests are directly involved, remarked another. By making his directive to Wright public, Roosevelt had taken the first step, however tentative, in what would become a slow, deliberate process of seeding a new and untried field of presidential power. Wright decided at the start to avoid venturing straight into the Pennsylvania coal fields, fearing that, as a representative of the president, his presence there would do more harm than good. Instead, he headed for New York, where he conducted a lengthy series of interviews with the presidents of the coal-carrying railroads, officials of the United Mine Workers Union, miners, and laborers. Wright sought to understand the pressures exerted on both sides, each answerable to its own constituency. The operators, responsible to their shareholders, claimed higher wages and shorter hours would drive several collieries out of business. "I cannot afford voluntarily to bankrupt my company," Bear explained, "by inviting losses that any man charged with the responsibility of management would say were unnecessary and unwise." Mitchell, voice of the fledgling union, had to prove to the miners that their lives would be improved by their commitment to collective action. And beyond the specific disputes about wages, hours, and working conditions, Wright concluded, the psychological elements must be considered to get a true measure of the situation. Suspicion lurks in the minds of everyone. Commissioner Wright told Roosevelt he could not complete his report without making a few suggestions that might lead to a more peaceful and satisfactory condition in the anthracite coal field. He proposed a 6-month experimental reduction from 10 to 9 working hours a day, to see how productivity was affected. To assuage the mistrust and ill will rippling beneath the surface, he recommended that when workers were paid by the ton, 2 inspectors, one representing the operators, one the miners, should be on hand to weigh the coal. And most significantly, he urged the creation of a joint committee on conciliation, composed of representatives of the operators and the new union. These steps, Wright acknowledged, would not lead to the millennium, but he believed would allay irritation and reach the day when the anthracite coal regions might be governed in accordance with greater justice. Remain uncommitted in the early stages. This is an important report by Carol D. Wright, Roosevelt told his Attorney General, Philander C. Knox. Will you read it over, and then at Cabinet we can discuss whether it shall be made public? I like its tone greatly. Knox strongly advised against its publication. He told Roosevelt that the affair was of no concern to the president, and that he could not see what good would come of publishing the report. Elaborating further, Knox reminded the president that the report had been made for his personal information, not because he had any responsibility for the situation. For you to make this report public would be construed as implying your approval of the findings of fact and the recommendations therein. I do not think you were called upon to thus commit yourself. Roosevelt pondered the weight of this argument. To publish the report with Wright's suggestions for improved working conditions might seem sympathetic to the miners. If, as president, he had already expressed an opinion on specific issues, he would find himself in an embarrassing and undignified position should duty eventually require him to intervene. Yet not to publish the report after it had been publicly announced might seem like an act of suppression, angering progressives anxiously awaiting some positive action. Caught in a crossfire, Roosevelt decided for the time being against making the report public. Summer. The seasonal clock was ticking. While there was no drastic change in the daily lives of the people in the heat of summer, each passing day brought factories, schools, and hospitals, along with millions of homeowners, closer to the necessity of securing their winter's coal supply. As supplies dwindled, and the dealers' bins were increasingly cleaned out, retail prices rose 50% to 60%. For the great majority of the people, an exorbitant burden. Reports from New England cities and towns revealed that even for those able to afford the onerous prices, the scarcity of coal was such that stockpiles could be found only here and there, in the hands of a few dealers. Doubtless, the stage is very near, the Coal Trade Journal predicted, when to all intents and purposes, supplies of anthracite will be entirely exhausted. Use history to provide perspective. That summer, with Congress in recess, Roosevelt closely monitored developments in the strike from his family's home in Oyster Bay. In the sanctuary of his library, he found what Lincoln had secured at the soldiers' home, the time and space in which to reflect upon the deeper roots of the struggle. A lifelong student of history, a voracious reader, and a historian himself, Roosevelt recognized that the collision between the owners and the miners, capital and labor, the rich and the poor, had been decades in the making. The labor problem, he comprehended, had entered a new phase in the wake of the Industrial Revolution. Great financial corporations, doing a nationwide and even a worldwide business, had taken the place of the smaller concerns of an earlier time. The old, familiar, intimate relations between employer and employee were passing. A few generations before, the boss had known every man in his shop. By contrast, Roosevelt surmised, it was unlikely that any but a random coal miner had ever laid eyes on the Reading Railroad president, much less befriended him. Furthermore, as a consequence of such consolidation, a crass inequality in the bargaining relation between the employer and the individual employee standing alone had developed. The miners, individually, were impotent when they sought to enter a wage contract with their employers. They could make fair terms only by uniting into trade unions to bargain collectively. Labor unions, Roosevelt understood, were bound to grow in size, in strength. And this historical inevitability, the great coal operators did not see. Roosevelt had not only read about the Gilded Age and the growth of combinations, trusts, and labor unions, His family's history provided a singular chronicle of how wealth had accumulated in the new industrial order. From his grandfather, Cornelius Roosevelt, who had become one of the five richest men in New York, through a successful career as a merchant, banker, and real estate magnate, Theodore had inherited a family trust. From his father, who had become a pillar of the New York philanthropic world, he had developed a sense of duty and civic responsibility. From his own experiences in the woods of Maine, among the cowboys in the West, as a civil servant in Washington, a police commissioner in New York, and a soldier in Cuba, Theodore had fashioned a different path from that imagined by noblesse oblige. He had confronted a larger vision of American diversity and had developed a more complicated conception of public responsibility and leadership. The history that was being played out in the strike of 1902 was part and parcel of his knowledge of history and his own family life, his biography, and his times. That same summer, Roosevelt embarked on completing the 10-volume biography of Abraham Lincoln by John Nicolay and John Hay. "He had not only enjoyed the reading," he wrote Hay, "but I really believe I have profited." Though he understood, of course, that the task before him differed in degree from what Lincoln saw in the supreme years of the nation's struggle, the men and forces at play were yet the same in their infinite variety of kind. Furthermore, he had a good idea of Lincoln's worry when he was denounced by extremists on one side for not going far enough, and on the other for going too far. In the present coal strike, conservatives were roundly denouncing him for showing sympathy with the miners, while progressives wanted him to take the coal barons by the throat. Most of all, Roosevelt emphasized, Lincoln's character provided the most telling model. To try to be good-natured and forbearing, and to free myself from vindictiveness. Be ready to grapple with reversals, abrupt intrusions that can unravel all plans. The explosion of an anarchist's pistol had made Roosevelt president. Grappling with such sudden twists of the kaleidoscope had shaped his philosophy of life and of leadership. So now, as the relatively peaceful strike entered its 12th week, a single violent incident at a colliery in the coal town of Shenandoah threatened to upend all hopes for a peaceful solution. From the start, Mitchell had counseled his men to avoid provocation and to keep their picket lines orderly. By late July, however, tempers were beginning dangerously to fray. On July 30th, a sheriff's deputy was escorting two men carrying a suspicious-looking bundle into the mine. Upon the discovery that the package contained miners' gear, the Union pickets turned on the scabs, clubbing and beating them into unconsciousness. Policemen rushed to the scene. Mobs gathered in the street. Upward of 1,000 shots were fired, the New York Times reported. Scores of strikers and local residents were hit. It is expected that many deaths will result. A citizen who came to the aid of the sheriff's deputy was brutally clubbed to death. Front-page headlines across the country proclaimed a reign of terror. Reading the dispatches at Sagamore Hill, Roosevelt considered returning to Washington. If the violence continued, it was possible that the Pennsylvania governor would request federal troops to maintain order. "Once there is a resort to mob violence," Roosevelt later told a friend, "the only thing to do is to maintain order." While such intervention was well within his constitutional authority, Roosevelt knew from his study of history that the arrival of federal troops would be construed as a coercive action on behalf of the operators, an action that could well break the back of the strike. It is a dreadful thing to be brought face to face with the necessity of taking measures, however unavoidable, which will mean the death of men who have been maddened by want and suffering. Waiting to see how the situation would unfold, Roosevelt remained vigilantly but quietly at home. His patience was rewarded. The following day, John Mitchell traveled to the site of the violence. He understood that even those members of the public most sympathetic to the miners' cause would not condone a disruption of law and order. A crowd of 10,000 miners greeted the union president when he reached Scranton. The men went fairly wild over his appearance, one newspaper reported, but they listened soberly when he pleaded with them to refrain from violence. "The one among you who violates the law is the worst enemy you have," he warned. "I want to impress on you the importance of winning this strike. If you win, there will be no more strikes. But if you lose the strike, you lose your organization." Because Theodore Roosevelt did not rush in, because John Mitchell did swiftly and effectively respond, an uncertain peace was restored once again to the Anthracite region. Reevaluate options. Be ready to adapt as the situation escalates. As the strike entered its fourth month, public anxiety deepened. Both sides were replenishing their coffers to hunker down for the long haul. The strike would come to an end, the owners repeatedly emphasized, only when the miners conceded defeat and returned to work. For their part, the miners, having solicited the largest strike fund ever accumulated from fellow union members in different parts of the country, had settled down to a long trial of endurance. On August 21st, rendered increasingly uneasy by this protracted stasis, Roosevelt queried his attorney general, "What is the reason we cannot proceed against the coal operators as being engaged in a trust? I ask because it is a question being continually asked of me." Indeed, reporters had suggested that the coal trust seemed in more flagrant violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act than Northern Securities, the vast transportation company against which Roosevelt had brought suit the previous February. Northern Securities, forged under the auspices of J.P. Morgan during Roosevelt's watch in late 1901, had consolidated three rival rail and shipping lines into one giant company, creating, behind Morgan's U.S. Steel, the second largest corporation in the world. The new holding company had absolute power to determine freight rates within its domain. The unforeseen announcement of the government suit to test the validity of the merger had staggered the financial world. "If we have done anything wrong," Morgan had informed Roosevelt in a White House meeting 3 days later, "send your man to my man and they can fix it up." Morgan's attitude, Roosevelt later said, was a most illuminating illustration of the Wall Street point of view, which regarded the president as simply a rival operator. With the Northern Securities suit, the first of a series that would establish for Roosevelt the moniker Trust Buster, the president intended to serve notice on everybody that it was going to be the government, not Wall Street, who governed these United States. In answer to the president's query concerning an antitrust suit against the coal operators, however, Knox argued that they were not combined in such a manner as to fit the legal definition of a trust. Furthermore, he reminded Roosevelt that even if a suit against the coal owners should eventually prevail, the slow workings of the court machinery would deliver no remedy for the crisis at hand. After 7 months, the Northern Securities suit was still in the first stage of argument in the federal courts. Nearly 3 years would pass before the Supreme Court finally decided the case in the government's favor. Troubled by the Attorney General's objections, Roosevelt contemplated a different, less controversial step. Perhaps, he suggested to Knox, the time had come to reevaluate his earlier decision to withhold the Wright report. Knox reiterated that he had never thought it wise for you to give it out and have no reason now to change my opinion. This time, however, after consulting with additional advisors, Roosevelt chose to move ahead and release the report to the press. Let the case be laid before the public. In the appendix of the report, which included the letters exchanged between the operators and the miners, the virulent animosity of the operators toward their employees spoke loud and clear. Again and again, the operators had refused to meet with Mitchell. As for the idea of insuring every miner a minimum daily wage, the owners countered that it was patent to anyone who had any knowledge of the differing conditions in different mines that such an idea can be but the product of an ignorant and diseased mind. Most significantly, the report revealed that the operators did not in any way feel answerable to the public. When Wright asked them if there were any sort of suggestion the president might make to help resolve the strike, the owners bluntly replied that if he and everyone else simply got out of the way, it will do more to end it than anything else. When Roosevelt released the report, he was careful to include Knox's opinion that the president had neither authority nor responsibility in the matter. But increasingly, Roosevelt felt otherwise. As representative of the public, he had substantial influence, if not the power of explicit law. And slowly, the idea that the public, whose lives and livelihoods hung in the balance of this increasingly bitter struggle, had a role to play, was beginning to take a firm hold. The seeds that Roosevelt had planted early in the struggle had begun to grow, nurtured by the expectations and needs of the public. Incrementally, the president had constructed a new kind of platform from which he could speak. And now, the time had come to build a foundation of support among the citizenry in the eye of the coming storm, the people of New England. Be visible. Cultivate public support among those most directly affected by the crisis. Even before the coal strike approached an acute stage, Roosevelt had planned a late summer speaking tour through New England and the Midwest to generate enthusiasm for Republicans in the upcoming fall elections. The mounting concerns of New Englanders about the prolonged strike gave the barnstorming venture a decided political jolt and accent. Traveling by train and open carriage from Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Massachusetts to Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine, Roosevelt attracted massive throngs every place he went. The booming of cannon, the clanging of church bells, the tooting of whistles, the braying of brass bands, and the cheering of thousands signaled his progress. Factories shut down, the Boston Daily Globe reported. Stores put up their shutters, flags were hoisted, and the people were out in their holiday clothes. It struck one journalist that small towns turned out their entire population. Roosevelt understood that people were drawn to see the president much as they would come to see a circus. His energy